Yeah, no, it's a major
I'd like to call the order the special meeting of the EIP committee. Just a reminder that there's no public comment. This is for information only. And we have three guest speakers or three guest organizations, the DEC, Cornell, and the Farm Bureau. And the plan is that DEC will go first, Cornell will go second, and then the Farm Bureau last. And each one of you will present up until 11 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock, we'll open up for questions.
Questions of what?
Yeah, excuse me. Questions from the legislature. So DEC, first, please introduce yourself. Yes, ma'am.
Is it green? Has to be green.
Yeah, it has to be green. Push that button, please.
Hold it down.
There you go. There we go. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm Molly Trembley. I work at the Albany DEC office. I'm in the Division of Materials Management and specifically in the section that deals with organics reduction and recycling. So we touch upon everything from yard trimmings, composting, food scraps, all the way over to biosolids. So we run the full gamut of all organics and solid waste. I can hit the next slide for me. Thank you. All right. So we're chatting about biosolids recycling today. And so just to walk us back, getting a quick overview, biosolids are from wastewater treatment plants, right? Carried through the sewer lines from homes, businesses, institutions, sometimes industrial facilities. And DEC regulates these wastewater treatment plants, as well as the beneficial use of the resultant biosolids. And that is regulated under Part 361 in our solid waste regs. So biosolids, when properly treated and processed, they can be recycled into a nutrient-rich organic material for use as a soil amendment. So this can replace commercial fertilizers and has been in action for decades. Thanks. All right. So in order to process biosolids in New York State and to use it as a beneficial use or recycle it, which could fall under all different types of activities, there's land application. Composting could be processed through a digester, and the digest state is used for recycling. There's several different avenues that this material could be processed through. A permit is required that's issued by DEC. So under Part 361-2, which is our land application regs, and 361-3, which is mostly our composting and other types of facilities regs related to this, they need to do the following. So a professional engineer needs to certify the plan. Detailed plans and specs and maps are all included. There are site-specific permits for land application specifically, so they're actually addressed per farm field as opposed to sort of one blanket acceptance. And then continual testing and monitoring in accordance with the regs, and that's all spelled out based on the quantity and type of material that you're processing. And then it's also inspected on a routine basis, and there is an annual reporting requirement for these facilities as well.
Just to give you an overview, join the meeting.
We have a solid waste management plan at New York State, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. This basically focuses on it's a high level look at statewide process for moving materials towards beneficially waste reduction and recycling. But it also focuses on all the existing facilities that, you know, will be around and that will continue to permit. This reaches everywhere from, you know, landfills and incinerator facilities all the way through to beneficial use and recycling, material recovery facilities for traditional recyclables, things like that. So this plan sort of, it covers it all. And it has a bunch of specific focus areas. And one of those focus areas is just organics management and recycling. There's goals in the Beyond Waste is what the name of the plan is. There's goals in the overall recycling plan, right? And total for the whole state, there is a very ambitious goal set of 85% recycling rate of all MSWs. So that's all municipal solid waste by 2050. This is not a requirement. I know there's been some questions about requiring biosolids to be recycled, for example. Solid waste management in New York State, including biosolids, is not something that We're mandating. This is always going to be a local decision of the municipality that operates and runs the wastewater treatment plant or the water resource recovery facility. So that's always going to be on them to make that decision of what to do with their solids. So whether that goes to landfilling or a beneficial use or some other use is up to that municipality. You've probably heard of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. I'll just cover this real quickly. Basically, there was a large statewide law that sets overall greenhouse reduction requirements, greenhouse gas reduction requirements, methane sources being the most significant. And 12% of the emissions overall from the entire state were calculated out to be waste, most of those from landfills, and the majority of that from organics in the landfill. So that's why you see a lot of movement on the sort of higher and political side towards pushing organics recycling. It's going to take a long time to see change in solid waste emissions. These have been placed in landfills for years, and they are not being taken out of the landfill, right, for processing. So it's going to take a long time to see incrementally over time these go down. But with implementing all of these pieces, we're hopeful to see progress. All right, so this is probably a little hard for some people to see, but what I'm trying to get across here is the quantity of biosolids managed in New York State right now and what's happening to it. So this is where it's all going right now. So that big on the left chart, you can see that really big blue section. That's all the biosolids in the state that's being landfilled. The gray pi square is what's going to beneficial use. And then the other one is being incinerated. And this accounts for both in and out of state activities. So if we look at the chart to the right, you can see the majority of biosolids that are being recycled are going to composting, almost 75%. And then about 20% of that is going to land application. Some in the state, some out of state, but that's sort of around 21%, sort of around where we fall right now. Thanks. Just to put it in perspective, there's a lot of agricultural land in New York State, and there's 6.5 million actively farmed acres in New York State alone, which is wonderful. And even more dedicated to ag districts, but 6.6 million, according to the 2022 census that Ag and Markets was looking at, that's how much that they're actively farming on currently. I know that this county has a high percentage of land here dedicated to farming activities, but then less than 30,000 spreadable are actually being spread on that acreage by biosolids. So it's less than 0.5% of the agricultural land in the state that's being farmed is actually receiving biosolids. And I just want to keep that in perspective. So while we're land applying about 21% of all the ones that are getting land applied, so that's, you know, even a portion of that 16, so a very small percent of biosolids are being land applied in the state. But on top of that, it's going to, the amount of farmland it's covering is fairly minimal compared to the rest of the nation. I think the total U.S. Percentage of biosolids being recycled is about 50-55% overall, including all forms of recycling. So it's just something to consider. Thank you. All right, PFAS. Let's talk about PFAS a little bit because this is a really hot topic and it's an emerging contaminant that we are all taking very seriously. What we know about PFAS is that it's widely used. It's ubiquitous in nature, right? It's called a forever chemical for a reason. It's hard to break down in the environment. It's not favorable for it to break down in the environment. And it's found in a ton of products that we already use every day. There are studies that show that some PFAS are linked to harmful health effects. The two most studied and most of concern currently at federal and state government are PFOA and PFOS. Though there are thousands of PFAS chemicals, which makes it challenging to study all of the health effects and all of the health risks. We really need more research on the best ways to measure PFAS in multiple types of media. So air, water, soil, fish and wildlife. And these are being done now, but they have a long way to go. And we need to know the risk associated with various human and environmental exposure levels. So how to best treat or destroy PFAS is also on the docket. We have some methodologies that have been proven to be successful, but there's entirely more that needs to be done in this front. Okay, next slide. Thank you. This is just kind of an idea of how PFAS moves around the environment. I won't spend too much time on this, but the basics are that it can come into water systems, land systems through a variety of ways and through all different types of media. So air deposition, water movement, you know, land. There's several ways that this can get to our environment, including discharges. So what DEC has started to do, and we have a very large group of every environmental quality division at DEC. So that includes water, air, minerals, fish and wildlife, remediation, all of these groups, and materials management that I'm in. And all these groups are sort of coming together to see how that we can prioritize source control and just in general work on the PFAS issue at hand. There are several bans in New York State to date. Years ago, there was a call nationally for a voluntary reduction in mostly large commercial applications, like your Teflons and things like that, to reduce the amount of PFAS. Some of that was very successful, and a lot of companies did reduce what they were producing. Some of them came out with other forms of PFAS to put into their products. So there's a long way to go on that, but New York State has taken actions to ban intentionally added PFAS in firefighting foam, food packaging, clothing and apparel. So think your Gore-Tex coats and things like that, carpeting. And then the newest one will be, the newest one that they're working on is all about like the paper, the food packaging, which is like, you know, your McDonald's wrappers and things like that. So these are things that are literally touching our food, but we have a long way to go. Nonstick cookware hasn't been touched yet. Cleaning products are large. We're seeing it in floor waxes in schools and things like that. And there's a lot of different cosmetics, right? We're putting it on our face. So there's a lot of different sources that need to be attacked at that higher level, and getting that out of the source will get it out of the byproducts, which is our main priority and the biggest bang for our buck when we're dealing with this material. And that's something that we've seen in other contaminants among the years, different metals. We've seen that with PCBs, et cetera. So these, getting them out of the commercial stream and the upstream is going to really help us and be critically important as we move forward. All right. So when we were looking specifically at biosolids and the wastewater treatment plant, we really wanted to model after Michigan's already really thorough work on the subject. They, between 2017, 18, and now, and they've done sort of a reiteration of this study, they've sampled at over 160 municipal wastewater treatment plants. They looked at many that were not both non-industrial impacted and industrial impacted. So they may have had someone upstream that was industrially impacting or had a discharge to that plant. So this could be like a metal finisher or a people that make the coating on the paper plates, you know, things along those lines, things that are known to have PFAS in them, products to have PFAS in them that are being generated, and the discharges go to these treatment plants. They implemented this large interim strategy for the recycling of biosolids with different limits and actions required depending on what the sampling came out to. And over the years, they've found a lot of success at reducing the overall amount of PFAS in those byproducts. So they've implemented some treatment processes, but what has been really successful for them and what they've spent a lot of time and effort working on is eliminating upstream sources to the plants. You'll hear the water treatment plants say that they are what's called passive receivers, right? They don't generate this material. It comes to them and it doesn't get pulled out in their traditional treatment processes that the water treatment plant already has existing. So these are now materials that they are sort of saddled with and need to treat from there. So Michigan is sort of targeting that upstream process and having a lot of success at removing it, but there's a long way to go. And what we are really interested in is what levels of reduction, monitoring, and testing need to happen to ensure that we're doing all the right things and that we're making sure that, you know, our water sources in New York State are safe for people and the environment. This is just kind of a quick glimpse at the wastewater treatment plant studied in Michigan. You can see that the industrial impacted ones, right, the ones with specific discharges from those PFAS industries were all found to be above 20 parts per billion of PFOA and PFOS in in the solids. Things under that were mostly coming from municipal sources, so our own homes and institutions. So that was sort of their cutoff, what they've studied and what they looked at. And it's the basis of how they decided at what levels along the process that they would implement certain restrictions. So we came out with DMM7 at DEC, which is a policy that's supposed to be, it's being implemented on the interim of waiting for larger federal risk assessment at EPA to be completed, which is supposed to be completed this month. And it establishes PFAS and PFOA sampling criteria for biosolids that are recycled in New York. So this policy is going to stay in place until EPA issues their risk-based standards, in after which DEC will incorporate that into further rulemakings statewide. So you'll see us taking action when we have the appropriate scientific backing and risk assessment completed to look at that. So this policy not only looks at that, but will provide data for what we need to address along the way. So we're currently looking at over 100 municipal wastewater treatment plants that all are either intend to or have an or are currently recycling their biosolids, and that's going to give us a good baseline. We can't regulate what we haven't measured, right? So we need to make sure that we know we have a good idea of the universe of what's going on, so that we can proceed in dealing with it appropriately based on whatever the risk assessment comes out to. And part of that is a contract with SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, or SUNY ESF. They have a large lab where they're working on looking at PFAS and biosolids, and then as well as the influent and effluent from the plants. So they will have an idea, and they'll be able to study how the influent, effluent, and biosolids are all related, because we don't know very well societally how much is going to move through the system versus stay in the solids. So we want a good idea and a good study on what is becoming of that. We're also looking in that the DEC staff have actually been going out and performing the sampling, and then SUNY ESF is doing the actual testing. And at the end, there will be a report published with all the information. We're getting close to the end. We're also following up on that because this is a research lab. We want to do confirmatory sampling study. So with the methods that are prescribed by EPA, which is standard method 1633, which is approved for the suite of PFAS chemicals, we'll be doing the same testing at a private lab that's ELAP certified for this study. And they will go into every sample that we got from ESF study that came in over 20 ppb. So we want to do confirmatory sampling and additional monitoring of all those that we deem to be potentially an issue. This would have the wastewater treatment operators themselves going in and doing the a one-time sampling event and sending it to this lab. These have both been free to the municipal plants. DEC has provided funding to get them done and work, because we know that nobody put emergency PFAS in their budget last year. So it's been great to be able to offer that. And in order to, move along and recommend a certain amount of routine monitoring going forward, we need to know what the universe looks like now. So that confirmatory sampling will help us really solidify what's going on there. And that we've already contracted with and we'll start very soon. This is just to give you kind of it's overwhelming, but that's why it's up here. When the EPA looks at their risk assessment of biosolids, which they did initially in, I think like the 80s or 90s, when they first started regulating biosolids beneficial use and land application, they went through a whole series of risk assessments with a lot of different places that they could go to. So the environment, different environmental impacts, different human exposures. So, maybe it would go through produce, right? And someone would eat the produce. They want to see what the risk is associated with that. They want to see what the risk is associated with the child that lives at the farm where biosolids are being applied, et cetera. So they look at all these different scenarios and they measure out all of the different risks associated with each one. And then they set regulations according to the most stringent risk scenario. So in that case, back in the 90s, it was a child living on the farm who could, you know, accidentally directly ingest biosolids. And so all of the results that EPA came out with at the time were all based on that study. New York has implemented regulations in parallel with EPA, but we also have additional ones that are more stringent. So we include not only some standards that are stricter, such as metals and things like that, but we also have things related to mostly nutrients. So establishing different buffer zones around where you're applying, like distance to waterways and buildings. We hydraulic loading on a farm. There's a lot of different things operationally that we implemented that is goes well beyond the federal regs. And we are able to do that again for PFAS if we see the need once the risk assessment comes out, because while the risk assessment addresses everything on a federal level, we will still need to look at that in context with New York State and determine what's best for us, our soils, and our processes. Oh, it's at the end. So I will now pass over to Jean Bonatal from Cornell Waste Management Institute, and I welcome questions at the end.
Thank you, Melanie.
Yeah, let me just bring that up there. My name is Jean Bonatel. I'm the director of Cornell Waste Management Institute. I have been working in this area on the farms in this area and communities for 35 years, something like that. So for a long time, I think I was asked to come to talk to you. I am an organic matter specialist. So I deal with anything that was once alive and is now dead and needs to be managed. So I deal with a lot of the high path avian influenza outbreaks, the disease outbreaks, brucellosis outbreaks in livestock, a lot of the mortality composting, and our butcher waste. We're having a lot of trouble with butcher prices and rendering and all that kind of stuff right now. So we're working even more with butchers on how do we dispose of all those materials. So we take material by material and look at that through the years. We have an extensive website that has a lot of this information on it. And I'm not the person that deals with biosolids. Those people have retired. You've heard from them in the past. Murray McBride, Ellen Harrison, wrote a document called A Case for Caution. That was updated, and it's been since updated. I sent some of the slides from Murray McBride that he updated in 2023 to Tess, and then they can go to people so that they have the most updated information on biosolids. I have been involved with biosolids spreading. I do work with the farms that are spreading biosolids. So I do all of that, but it's around the edges pretty much. The case for caution really was based on bios on metals. Okay. So we have 9 metals that we have rules for per EPA and our 360 DEC regs. I work with DEC a lot. We work in hand on organics because it's such a huge issue right now. It was based on metals. We also take into account salmonella and fecal coliform, but we only have to pass one or the other of those. So we really don't look at very much in the biosolids. We look at it as class A, class B. But then the PFAS information came forth. And as Molly said, it's pervasive in the environment. But it's pervasive in the environment because we've put it there. It's from human action. It's not from the natural environment. So we have to physically take it and put it someplace. And then it can cause contamination problems for all of us. So I look at all of this stuff all the time. I test for drugs in euthanized animals to see how they break down and look at all of that kind of stuff and know where we're going to ultimately dispose them, including anthelmatics, because we got kind of nervous about anthelmatics. That's a wormer. Okay, so it's something that all of us, humans, everybody else takes a wormer at some point in their life, depending on where you live. But we use it on squirrels, we use it everywhere. We've looked at that also, because we were worried that if when that animal poops on the ground, is that going to affect the natural environment? Is that going to affect all of the microorganisms that we need to live in those soils? We did find out that it breaks down pretty quickly, and we didn't have to worry about that about 6 days in a compost pile. So because we need all of these microbiomes.
Mary, join the meeting.
We can't afford to lose our ecology systems, or our lands are no longer fertile and we will have problems. We'll have contamination. I was on Dixon Farm 2 years ago. They wanted to compost some food scrap. So I was asked to come down and do that. And I said, if it will make the quality of the farm better, I will help work on that. But for 38 years, I believe, they've been importing biosolids. And, you know, the 38 years ago, we probably had a lot less of the PFAS. But we have a lot more of it. The microplastics, our facial stuff that we, you know, our microbeads and all that kind of stuff that go in, our microplastics, all that stuff, we get more and more and more of that. And we're importing a lot of PFAS to the farms. I'm very excited. I work with the ESF lab on fabric finishes for the cotton industry and looking at the PFAS potential in those. We did very well there. We've reduced that quite a bit, especially in cotton denims and that kind of stuff. All those fabric finishes that we have, the washes, the ashes washes, all that kind of stuff. So that's good news, because all of our wash water goes into our sewage also. So it's our detergents, it's all of those things. Our hair dyes, those are probably potentially more damaging than a lot of other things. So, but it's all there, it all goes down. So so we are importing, and Steuben County has handled more than her share. I know that a lot of the biosolids that has been put on the land here on the farm, on the 4,000 acres plus, was more local. But now we're thinking that we should be importing, I'm gonna shit from Long Island and putting it on our farms here. That really seems like a problematic situation. First of all, the carbon footprint is horrible. We have to haul that stuff. I can get free wood chips anywhere in the state, but it might cost me $2,000 in diesel fuel to move those wood chips. And the carbon footprint is horrible. So if I really need it, I get it. But there are reasons why we don't want to be moving things that far and looking at things that way. I will end with a couple questions. Who's benefiting from the land spreading? And these are rhetorical, I don't expect answers. Who's benefiting from the land spreading of sludge? Is the soil? Are the cows? Is the farm? Crops? Farmers? The farmer? The hauler? The community? We got to think about who's actually benefiting, because a lot of the nutrients, the PFAS, the contaminants that are being brought here are coming all in a package. We can't separate those out. So we're over applying nitrogen and phosphorus because of biosolids. And I know there's nutrient management planners, and there are probably some here in the room, I'm hoping. But they have to balance all that kind of stuff out for the farm. And I think that's probably done it. That's probably been done, but it doesn't take into account the other problems, the PFAS that have for the last 15 years sort of raised their ugly heads, things like that, that we have to take into consideration. There are other metals. I also worry about hormones. We have Cialis, Viagra, we have our natural hormones that we pee out all the time. We saw problems in the Maryland shores where amphibians were changing sex because of the hormones that were given to poultry to create larger breasts. They wanted the males, the roosters, to have breasts so that we could use them for a meat industry. It's logical, but it took that hormone to do that. So then the runoff from all of that was changing the sex of amphibians. So talk about transgender. We cause it sometimes. I think we cause it and we don't know very much about it. So just bringing these things up, I just want to make sure. I think New York State does a pretty darn good job of nutrient management in general without biosolids. Without importing biosolids. We have a lot of dairies in New York State. We recycle all of those nutrients onto the farm, onto the different acres, and we can get it further out. We know that if it's 5 miles out, or 5 miles within a 5 mile radius, it gets more manure, the farm part away from the barn, but we can get it further out and we can use those nutrients and use them properly by direct incorporation, by direct spreading, proper spreading, all of that kind of stuff. And we really don't need the biosolids compost to be used on farms. I really think that it's one of those things that it has bitten this community in the butt, and it will affect many others who decide to import it. There aren't a lot of communities that have decided to do that. We have that 0.5%, was it, or something like that. And I know where most of those farms are. I did find out recently that some people up in the Northeast New York were importing sludge from Vermont and Canada. It's like, and we also, as a society, we also bring in a lot of Milorganite. And Milorganite, why is Milwaukee's shit better than ours? I don't think it is, and it's had problems. You know, at one point, Milwaukee's Milorganite, somebody decided to dump probably an 8-ounce cup of mercury down a drain, and it contaminated the whole load of compost because mercury is highly toxic. And it contaminated a lot. So they had to do a recall of it. But it's somebody cleaning out grandma's attic or grandma's basement and dumping stuff down the drain that we don't know about. And that's the cautions that I want to give us in deciding what should happen. I think ESF and the Sierra study should continue. We should be looking at all these things and then making decisions based on our loading rates. And loading rates are year after year after year, putting manure on, or human manure on those fields. And that all accumulates. I'll tell you, I just end with a heavy metals story. I was taking down, working with Mary McBride to check this out, but taking down a kid's playground, a school playground that was a memorial playground, had been up for 22 years. And they needed to replace it, and they wanted to lose the pressure treated lumber that it was built with. So I said, well, I was on the board at the time, the school board at the time. And I said, well, why don't we check and see what the soil looks like under the playground to make sure that we don't have, that we either should take all that soil out and put in fresh stone or fresh rubber, crumb rubber, or whatever we're going to do under it. Or, you know, look and just see, investigate what we should be doing. So we took that down. We looked at the uprights and, you know, tested the soil right around those areas. And in the uprights and the bridges, those funny bridges that kids walk across, those were the places where we had soil contamination. And around those upright upright beams, the heavy metals only moved 12 inches in 22 years. So they leach into the soil and they only move. They stay right there. The lead is around each of our houses if we live in an older house. So we have those legacy things that we do deal with, and we don't need to exacerbate those situations. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. Farm Bureau.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me here today. I'm Scott Ward, and I am the vice president for the Steuben County Farm Bureau. And the president would have been here. However, he's down south with his toes in the sand. So I got the nod to talk to you today. And as a matter of fact, right now, our secretary and treasurer, Jeff Valinda Parker, are at the state annual meeting, which happens every year where we go over policy and so on for this upcoming year that we have lobbyists for and then lobby for different things that the you know, the membership wants. We're a grassroots. Oh, before I finish that, I've been in the ag industry or a farmer or a soldier my entire adult life. So I got a little bit of ag experience behind me. But Farm Bureau is a grassroots volunteer policy development organization representing the majority of positions of the majority of the members. So you can see it's a majority rule type organization, but I'll allude to something a little bit later in my presentation. There's over $5 billion generated in revenue from nearly 33,000 farms within the state. 99% of those farms are family-owned farms, even though they might be an LLC because of, you know, the way they want to structure things. But we don't have a lot of corporate-type farms within New York State. And also, you know, you have to think of the farmers, the brewers, the cideries, the vineyards, and the wineries, which add also to the makeup of agriculture in New York State and also Steuben County. There's a old saying that without farmers, you'd be naked, hungry, and sober. So it's a good thing we have them. policy resolution starts at the county level. Essentially, the county will get together, and if there's an issue, they'll bring it up before the board. The board will say yay or nay on whether that moves up. And then after that, that moves to the district. And then they review set policy, and they might modify or change it a little bit or wordsmith. And then ultimately, it would make it to the state level, which is a state annual meeting, which is being held today at Turning Stone Casino. So these resolutions obviously will be updated, modified, or deleted. Section five, there's five sections within the resolution book. And as you can see, the environment is 36 pages long. And it's second only to general issues, which is only two pages longer than that. So we take great pride in becoming a partner with the environment, because the environment makes the farmers money if they don't take care of it. So that's something that's very important to us. We're here to talk about biosolids. And the State Farm Bureau policy reads, and when I talked about, you know, deletion and so on, the very first plank that was in the environment line is being stricken this year because it resorts back to data from 1997 and 2006. So we want to stay as current as possible all the time. That's why these things are reviewed constantly, these policies. So this is the policy of the New York Farm Bureau. We support the education of both farmers and the public on the benefits and concerns of using biosolids as a source of fertilizer and using information provided by the New York State Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environmental Conservation. These agencies are the appropriate regulators for the use of this product, and municipal prohibitions restricting the use of biosolids should not be allowed. That's the position of the State Farm Bureau, and that's the position of the County Farm Bureau, because we support that. The Board of Directors did discuss this at our last board meeting, knowing that we were going to have somebody come up and talk about this today. So we had it wasn't super lengthy, but we did discuss it, and we agree with the state's position. Our county, as with any county, can disagree with whatever the state puts forth, because when they have a vote and it goes, and my very first time going to the state annual meeting was eye-opening, because I thought, okay, this is my first time going, but it was run very, very efficiently. And I was really amazed that a bunch of volunteer farmers could do such a great job. But we got a lot of great professionals within the ag industry. Farm Bureau and DEC at times have a love-hate relationship, as both of us are dedicated advocates to the natural environment. We believe they will provide adequate and equitable oversight, because obviously we're not scientists, so we're relying on their expertise and so on to, you know, advise and consult. I live up in an area where I have a well, and there's ag land all around, and, you know, there's a fair amount of herbicides and pesticides and so on that are applied. And when I draw a glass of water, I feel confident that the water that I'm drinking is safe and pure. So in closing, throughout the Farm Bureau policy book, we support the enactment of decisions at the appropriate level. Farms increasingly spread across multiple municipal boundaries, laws governing land use and farming practices that are applied as broadly as possible are least disruptive to farm operations. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, sir. Questions, legislatures? Hilda.
A person, a resident of our county, comes to talk to us for probably what, the last 15 years to talk about this. And, you know, everyone kind of booted.
Hold on.
Everyone kind of poo-pooed it because it was, you know, over and over and over again about the same issue. And now it's come to fruition that it is an issue. And he's been talking about it. It's happening. But I keep asking, or people keep saying, well, what can the county do? What can the county do to help? And I hear, oh, we can't do anything. Well, I don't know if that's true. But I'm saying, what can the county do to help with this situation? I'm asking, I don't know who to ask that question to, but we need to know, what is it?
Right. I think my question, it was going to be to Molly on that. Molly. Does the DEC test individual batches of whatever is being spread, or how does the testing work and how does the approval work?
Yep. Good question. So under their solid waste permit, they're required to do a certain amount of testing of the material throughout the year. It has to be spread out throughout the year to make sure that they're getting good samples from what they're looking at. Before they get a permit, they have to test the sources that are coming in. So the individual wastewater treatment plants at a certain frequency. And then they also have to test like the soil. And then they'll also continue that testing as the permit goes on and as they land apply. It's done at a frequency dependent on how much biosolids are being processed. So larger facilities will do more routine testing than smaller or infrequent ones. And they're all outlined in our regulations, but these do not currently include PFAS in our regs. They could in the future, if rules come out, and a risk assessment shows that it's necessary for EPA, and we would be ready to address that in our own regulations, and we do have the authority to do so. Something else that's being looked at is our Division of Water is very, I mean, obviously equally concerned, right, at the wastewater treatment plants. They're worried about the inputs, the outputs, everything in between. The traditional treatment route at the wastewater treatment plants is not going to take care of the PFAS. So not only are they looking at the influence of what's coming in, but they're looking at treatment possible treatment methods at the plants themselves. They're doing these through several initiatives, one of them through what they affectionately refer to as TOGS, but they're guidance documents that basically say how they're going to move forward at treatment plants with certain, it spans the whole board, but a new one just came out, it's TOGS 1314, that basically goes through related to PFAS and says how they're going to monitor this, how they're going to look at it going forward. And we're working in concert with them to make sure that those match up. So depending on what they're all going to have to look at PFAS, different PFASs, or PFAS and PFOA, and they're now going to need to react based on what their levels are. So ones with a very low level or non-detect will not need to do as much as ones that have higher levels or more concerning levels. And these range anywhere from, they start with additional monitoring and upping what they do currently, and including PFAS and what they currently do, upping the amount of monitoring, and then they could lead all the way to refusal from beneficial use or not recycling it if the levels are too high. So that's currently the plan between Materials Management and Division of Water, and it's covered in a couple of those.
So you had mentioned 20 parts per billion. Is that basically the level at which anything lower than that is deemed relatively safe with the initial studies? Or what is the concerning amount? Because I saw the chart that went up to like 15,000 parts per billion, but it's a billion. So, you know, that's a pretty...
Yep. So there's different things to look at here. So there's different media, right? So we're looking at biosolids, is looked at differently, and soils are looked at differently than water itself. So there's drinking water standards that are going to be different than soil standards. And we have groups working on what those soil standards should be. There's people looking at rural background information for all of these soils and what's in there already, whether there's been any farming activity, any land application activity, anything at all or not. And they're finding it everywhere. So the rural background study will be able to show us, you know, just with air deposition, use in other ways of how this is getting around in the environment. And then, I'm sorry, what was the second part?
So I guess it was, what was the safe amount? And you said it depends on the medium. So I guess the medium we're most concerned with is the spreading that happens. So the material that comes out of the wastewater treatment.
I gotcha. Sorry.
The medium that we're concerned most with, I think.
Yep. So our DMM7, that 20 parts per billion that I was talking about, that's what we're looking at as an interim process. That's going to get our biggest impacts out before, EPA comes out with their final numbers. So water, direct water, your drinking water, has a much lower concentration that is statewide, that it's in the PPT range, parts per trillion.
Right.
And soil is higher in the parts per billion range. And that's because of the way that the environment interacts with that media. So it accounts for, you know, rain, different air deposition, just, you know, leaching through the material and how it gets to our waterways and the dilution factors and things like that.
So 20 parts per billion would be the estimated save for the manure that's or the waste that's being spread?
Not exactly. 20 parts per billion is where we've determined that there's an industrial large impact to that wastewater treatment plant that needs to be addressed, a source that we need to go after, a source that the wastewater treatment plant will now need to track down and provide a minimization plan. So they will now need to go back and look at all their upstream sources and address those. 20 parts per billion is not some magical safe number. We are waiting on risk assessment from the health department, from EPA, and in concert with the health department, where we'll look at what's safe for the environment versus humans. 20 parts per billion is this impacted industrially?
So would you say then samples that come back with less than 20 parts per billion are pretty common? Because my understanding, every sample is basically going to come back with some amount of PFAS.
Sure. Many of them will. Soil, biosolids, air, water, everything is registering at some level, whether it's PPT or higher. 20 parts per billion is just our legal cutoff for where we're going to start addressing that industrial source. But yes, many of them will come back under 20. And from what we've looked at so far, anecdotally, the majority of them are under those limits. Some will not be, and that's what we're trying to find out.
Okay.
Joe?
Jean had a good point, and it kind of hit home when she mentioned that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, PFAS wasn't a concern. But now that we've continued to dump these chemicals in our soil, it's a concern now, obviously. So my question to you, Molly, is, you know, Do water filters, such as the ones you put on your faucet or the ones that come with refrigerators now, do they reduce the number of, harmful chemicals that we drink, if there are some?
That's a good question. There's a lot of studies still to be done on the appropriate levels of treatment for drinking water. It's not my expertise. I know that when DEC addresses contaminated issues at sites like that we've seen in the past, like Hoosick Falls, et cetera, they have put these treatment devices into people's homes. There's been a lot of proven studies on treating things with granular activated carbon at wastewater treatment plants that are removing a lot of contaminants. A lot of research is being done on reverse osmosis techniques, which would be great because, you know, with carbon, you still are left with a material that you need to manage, right? It has to go somewhere. So there's a lot of research being done in that field. Yes, there are treatment methods. The question is, are they effective enough and get to the right amount?
Thanks. Thank you.
Kelly.
I have a few questions. I wondered, as far as the certifications that are done to be permitted, how often are those done? Do you do it once and you're done, or do you have to recertify?
You have to recertify. So depending on how long your permit is for, it's either 5 or 10 years. Most of them are 5 currently.
Okay. And then on those, once you have the permit and you're doing it, there's a annual reporting, you said, that had to be done.
Yep.
Is there any auditing or verification that the annual reports are done correctly?
Yeah, we look at them ourselves in our section every year, all the biosolids annual reports, and then the regions. So our structure here at DEC is we have an Albany Central office, and then each region, which is a group of counties across the state, right? There's 9 regions total, are actually sort of our boots on the ground. They're doing the inspections, they're leading enforcement across the state, et cetera, and they kind of do the routine monitoring of that. They also look at these annual reports and assess them every year as well. We make sure that, you know, we look at everything down to, was the holding time on that material that was sent to the lab appropriate? So yes, they are looked at annually. And okay, all of the things in the regs that are required to be a part of that, all of the sampling that's required and the monitoring, they have to provide sufficient amount of that in their annual report.
How old is the waste management plan, and how frequently is it looked at and updated?
The first one is pretty old. I don't know, 20 years, the first one ever. This was just updated last year, the one right now. I think that what happened initially was it was very large and encompassing, and it still is very encompassing, but they wanted to make it so that they could update it more frequently and look at the data more frequently, especially now that we have different, you know, a lot of technology has come a long way for us to be able to see the data on a more frequent basis. And so it was just updated, and it will continue to be updated every couple of years, every 2 years as we go forward.
Okay. We talked about the number or the percentage. It's 0.5% of 6.6 million acres where biosolids are spread. That's still 33,000 acres. And if a lot of those acres are in one area, it makes it more concerning to me than it is if you look at the percentage. So I just wanted to make that comment. I wondered who specifically is doing the research on the effect of those forever chemicals?
Who's doing the research on PFAS in general?
Yes.
Everybody. Yeah. It's good. It's happening everywhere. It's happening on a federal level. It's happening at a state level. We have groups down to looking at, you know, fish tissue and stuff. Everything's happening. There's a lot of private research.
Yeah, and three to five years, this has just started.
Yeah.
So we haven't been looking at any of this stuff before then. There was some work in Vermont on PFAS. I know the Vermont Compost Company was very concerned about all of that. And so they were talking about it before anybody else. But we're talking about this.
Excuse me, Gene. Gene, would you step up the microphone, please, so we can hear?
We're talking about this at all levels, from plant uptake to everything else. It's really, really hard to clean out of the environment. And that's what I'm seeing. Molly mentioned reverse osmosis. We can't desalinate enough water through reverse osmosis for most islands. And we need to on most islands. So it's not a very efficient process to be able to do that. Molly, I wanted to ask a question toward you also, just to clarify something. And that is, what records are kept on the farms of where the biosolids is laid down, applied, and how often do they reapply? Because the loading rates are kind of based on, if we do it every year, and 503s, EPA 503s are based on doing it like every 5 years, you'd put another load down. So if you can comment on loading rates.
Yeah. Yeah, loading rates are looked at for us. I mean, it depends on how often, if there's going to be a single application or if there's going to be multiple in the year, they need to describe that in their application and their permit. So they'll have to address all of that when they apply and then as they're operating. They need to account for every field annually. So when they actually are doing their annual reporting for these land application facilities, they are not only submitting what they did the previous year, but what they're intending to do in the future year. They forecast the year. They forecast the fields they go to. They forecast the amounts that they spread. And we check those to make sure that they're in line with the regulations.
So. And just one other thing. If biosolids are brought in from outside the area, are they tested before they get spread?
That's a good question. So we do export a lot of biosolids as a state. So go to Pennsylvania, New Jersey for different uses. But there are a couple of materials coming in as well. Some materials, I think Gene mentioned one that was coming in from Vermont or Canada. There's a large facility right up on the Canadian border that takes some materials in, a lot from the state, a few from out of state as well. And they have a different, they don't land apply. It's a different kind of process, but there's a lot of places taking in out of state plants. What I think you might be referring to is like a finished product, right? So if a biosolids compost comes into the state, yeah. So if a biosolids material, finished material, or something that we consider a finished product, which is all you also hear it referred to as class A material. So it was processed to a certain extent that the pathogens are of a low enough extent that it can be used for free use. So this is the highest level of treatment required under the rules. And we make sure that any material that comes in from out of state, and there's a lot of them from Massachusetts, New Jersey, Connecticut, there's a handful. There's about 10 total that come in. They need to get approval through us. So we look at the testing of their product and their source material, so their wastewater treatment plant byproduct, right? The solids themselves. And we make sure that they fall in line with the same standards that that we set forth for our own facilities. We don't regulate the processing. That's done in another state, and they are required to give us their permit when they do that, a copy of their permit. But the material coming in from another state is looked at for all those standards, the metals, the nutrients, that kind of thing.
So they look at it, provide you with a report. We don't audit those, right?
We look at them, yeah, annually.
Okay.
But as you stated, though, right now the process does not include any sort of restrictions on PFAS, right?
Correct. The restrictions on PFAS right now are with DMM7 and the recycling of biosolids sources in New York State. I expect them to expand in the future.
Scott?
I'm guessing it was probably 15 years ago that the Chesapeake Bay Watershed project was started. And I think it includes six states, and we're in that because our water ends up down there eventually. I know that a lot of the municipal water treatment facilities around here had to make some significant upgrades, which was very costly to do that. If this EPA report comes out and they have, you know, targets on what needs to be met, is that where they start? Is that the treatment facilities, or do they obviously go upstream and say what you're sending us has to be cleaned somehow?
That's a good question. So EPA's assessment is going to look at the health and environmental risk impacts from biosolids, period. So regardless of where it comes from, right, any biosolids, it's the health and risk to us and the environment around us. We will then take all that data of what's considered safe, and we will be able to implement that for New York in our own regulations. And we are able to be more stringent than what EPA later does if we need to be. Something to note about the wastewater treatment plants is under the current guidelines and requirements that are set for them, they will need to look upstream first at their industrial users. So yes, that is a bit of a time commitment and a process for those treatment plants to go upstream, look at what's happening. But it's way better to go upstream and grab those ahead than installing a really expensive treatment system on the back end. Okay. Also, that just delays the inevitable, and it's better to get it out up front than to just be constantly treating it at the end. Something else that's happening that will help the wastewater treatment plants quite a bit is some new regulations for landfills that are going in about the storage and treatment of leachate that comes off the landfills. So for those that don't know, landfill leachate goes typically to a wastewater treatment plant after it's taken out. So it's collected right in the engineered landfill and then moved to the wastewater treatment plant, which has been noted as a source of PFAS for those plants. So there are regs going in as we speak. I don't know exactly where they're lying right now. They'll go out for public comment, but there's regs in development right now that would have them capture that material and then have to treat it before, either keep it or treat it.
And that was actually the reason I was asking the question is we operate a landfill. We have our own treatment facility, but then we send that down to the one here in Bath and they treat it again before it's, dispersed. So.
Right. So there's some rules.
I'm just wondering what financial impact we as a county will be looking at. And I think just my observation in this whole discussion of the Dixons and the Casellas that are the ones that are slaughtered through all this, but really they're picking up stuff from a treatment plant and bringing it and dumping it. So if it's bad, it's coming out of the treatment plant. And if the treatment plant is receiving things that they have to treat, and it still has PFAS in it, then you have to go farther upstream. So it's the sources of the PFAS in the beginning, which is what your presentation showed you're trying to limit and reduce. That's kind of the overall key to this whole process.
Yeah, source reduction is really going to be key for the whole state. It, as far as PFAS goes, getting it out of the system is the most important. And that's why we have so much happening around bans. And I'm recording it right now, but we're all in like a conference right now with Michigan about this topic. And so I'll go back and watch the recordings, but we have a whole pollution prevention unit at DEC that works implementing the laws that are put in the apparel, the carpet, the firefighting foam, all that. So we have a whole unit there that is going to EPA next week. They received a big grant to do a lot of studies and removal of these materials there. So there's a lot of movement on that like on that higher end, right? That big picture stuff and the source material. And that really is where we're going to succeed long term in getting this out of our all of our resources.
Fred, you're next.
Molly keeps referring to, you know, working upstream. Basically, the Clean Water Act that we all, our taxes went toward many years ago, 20, 25 years ago, that's what's doing all of this. So we went upstream, we looked at all the different sources of contaminants, dry cleaning places, Kodak, you know, all places like that, to the point where some of those places have to have their own sewage treatment plants within, and they're handled privately. So it's very different. But we're going up. We looked at gas stations. We took out leaking tanks. We did all that kind of stuff. So we're working on that. Now we're really aiming, a lot of our point sources are farms. And we're seeing stuff run off, whether it's from human manure or cow manure or dairy or whatever animals we have on livestock we have on the farms, that's happening. And it's affecting our lakes and ponds and rivers and drinking water to the point where there were situations up in the North Country. I live in the North Country, right up on Lake Ontario. So I live up that way. I also live next to the farm where we had the only moratorium on spreading dairy manure. So up in Sandy Creek, and I had nothing to do with the ban suggestion or anything else, but I happened to live in the house next to that large field where they were spreading. And they had contaminated so many wells in an area north of us because they just kept moving all of their manure off the Lake Ontario shore where their farm was and bringing it inland to Route 11, to that corridor, and totally fouled water to the point where it will never be drinkable. They will never be able to use those wells or those aquifers in those areas, in some other areas up in the North Country where, you know, other things were spread, like whey and milk waste and things like that. So some of those things are pretty irreversible. We can't clean some of these things up. So that's what the Clean Water Act did for us and continues to do for us. So that's just where it's heading. And we're looking at these sources. And I've been nervous about landfill leachate going to our sewage, our wastewater treatment plants for a long time, just because I think there are other things associated with it that can come in and affect things.
Brad, you're next.
I'll tag off from what you just said. PFAS, is my understanding, is a forever chemical. And if these places are spreading it on the fields year after year and a year, it doesn't it seem logical that PFAS levels are just getting higher and higher and higher in those areas where it's being spread? And therefore, the contamination is spreading more and more? Yeah, exactly.
That's a good question. That's something that needs to be studied a lot more. It's not only that. There's a lot of directions we need to go in. How much gets to groundwater from the soil? How much moves in plant uptake, right? How much is moving around? How much? And while we say, you know, it doesn't break down in soil, some of them do break down to an extent, but they'll break into other PFAS chemicals, right? Shorter chains and things like that. And they all have different levels. Currently have studied health impacts, of which are still being looked at, PFOA and PFOS being the most relevant right now, but we'll probably see a large increase in what the study around all the other suite of chemicals as we move forward. Again, there's a lot of work to do, you're right. And there's, we're really trying hard, especially at DEC, to kind of hit that biggest bang for our buck, right? We're taking all the resources we have and all the knowledge we have and throwing it into getting these huge sources, because these are such a big deal. I personally and professionally understand why this is such a concern, right? That's why we're putting so much into this. And it makes a big difference to kind of reflect on how we've dealt with emerging contaminants of the past, right? And how we've been able to manage those, and like pre-treatment programs that have been put in and looking upstream, right, to all those industries. Those have been able to successfully manage a lot of different contaminants in the past, and we really need to push forward with how we're going to handle these similarly. And while they're different chemicals, it's a similar process in how we look at it and how we deal with it and how we're going to continue to manage to get it out of our waste stream as a whole and treat it as we go forward. Obviously, treating it at the end is going to be the most expensive, the most time consuming, the hardest to do. So getting it out of the source, I know I'm a broken record, but that is what's most critical to us.
Joel, do you have a question?
Molly, I got three questions that kind of go together here. First of all, when you do studies at the DEC, do you do them as this as a whole within the state, or do you do different parts like South Central? Or do you even more specific study individual counties? That's my first question. Second question is, are there parts of New York State, are there parts of rural New York State that have higher amounts or concentrations of PFAS than other rural areas in New York State? And my third part is, how do we compare to other areas or other counties here in Steuben County with our concentrations or what you're finding from our farm communities here?
Sure. Yeah, those are good questions. And actually, I am not the expert on what exists like rural background right now, but our Division of Environmental Remediation is doing a really large study across the entire state of background soil everywhere and in all different types of areas. And it's looked at different population densities, it's all over the board. And that should be coming out pretty soon where they looked at everything. I mean, they're finding stuff from, and I don't have exact numbers, but, you know, in a high peak that has never had anyone on, you know, any industry involved in anything from air deposition. So I can't compare Steuben County to the things around it, but that report, which will come out soon from our remediation folk, that will have up all that information that you're looking for.
Thank you.
Carol.
Going back to the question, what can Steuben County do? Can we ban biosolids coming in from other areas other than in our county?
I don't know if I am appropriate to answer that. As you know, there's a moratorium on, I think, solid waste facilities as a whole in the town of Thurston. Is that what it is? So, and the Ag and Markets is looking at that as a right to farm law issue. So I think that would be something better addressed by Ag and Markets.
Can always be stricter than.
Can you go to the micro? All those people online can't hear you unless you're at the microphone.
Local ordinances can always be stricter than federal, state, county. So you can have you can put in a local ordinance and there's, you know, some people say, well, it affects right to farm, but this isn't really right to farm at this point. This is importing waste and using it maybe for nutrients, but we're going to find that out maybe for some of the nutrients, but also bringing in the bad with the good and maybe over applying some of the NP and K, the nitrogen.
Wendy?
Yes, to bring this back to Steuben County, this is from Ollie. How can the DEC, knowing that there are PFAS concerns coming from wastewater treatment, how can the DEC either allow or justify a permitting modification to bring at least double the amount up from Long Island, knowing that there's issues?
Are you talking about a specific site?
To come into Steuben County area.
So let me start broader, and then I don't know if any, you want to jump in? Yeah, I'll start broader. So we are concerned with PFAS as a whole, for sure. And we're looking at that overall. So when we look at a site specifically, we might need to address things differently site by site, right? So when we can't really, let me rephrase, it's hard to put a blanket prohibition on something like that when we're not seeing for sure scientifically backed evidence that it's an issue everywhere, right? So what we need to do is look at what's happening at each site and go from there. I'll have Greg talk about the specifics of what you're talking about, but when you're looking at these materials, we are trying to go after the highest impacts right now, right? We want to get it out as fast as possible. We want to get the most out, the most cost-effective way, the most resource and labor-intensive way, and we're doing our best to do that. We also will be promulgating regulations when the health impacts risk assessment comes out. So that may change things, that may not. I'm not sure. I'm not doing that risk assessment. But something else to note is when we are doing these applications, right, PFAS unrelated, we are looking at these for what's going to be the most conservative thing to apply. So if the applying for the nitrogen requirement of the crop is what's going to be the most conservative, that's what we apply to. If there's a phosphorus issue in the area, that's what we apply to. So that limits the land application of that based on that. So in the future, if there's some specific thing, a trace metal, a nutrient, anything like that, that's what we will hold the land application committee to, and that's what they need to apply to ensure they're not breaking any regulations or rules. And I'll have Greg, if you want to pop up and...
I'm Greg McLean. I'm the Regional Division of Materials Management Supervisor for Region 8, which encompasses the Western Finger Lakes, including all of Steuben County. I think I know what you're asking about regarding, I assume, the Casella Bonnie Hill facility, former Dixon facility. There's a proposed permit modification in front of us to bring in additional waste source of biosolids from a treatment plant on Long Island. That permit modification application has not been made on that application yet. That's still under our review. My understanding is that that modification does not encompass any increase in the amount of biosolids that the facility is already permitted to take in and land apply. I hope that answers your question.
Will?
I did have a question for Scott. Figured he was being left out here.
How can I help you?
Not you, Scott. Has the Farm Bureau discussed what the impact would be if there was any sort of restriction or ban on the spreading of biosolids? Because I know that the Farm Bureau's position that you talked about said it should be at a state level, but I'm just wondering in terms of impact on individual farmers and farms.
Well, I mean, you know, the farm or farms that were utilizing that as a form of fertilizer, obviously they're going to have to use other fertilizers to make up that difference.
Right. Is there a readily available supply that would be able to kind of slide into that gap with the...
Well, yeah, I mean, you could purchase it. You go all Nutrien and they'll show up with truckloads of whatever your fertilizer you might need. So it's, I mean...
Right.
Yes. I mean, it's available. It's not like, you know, a gun held to your head saying you got to use this stuff, but, you know, it's a form of cost savings. And like the one speaker did talk about years ago, you know, before we had all these luxury items or, you know, like Teflon and Vortex and, you know, a lot of these neat things, we didn't realize that we were ultimately, you know, making things that were toxic and that go into, you know, ultimately the ground one way or another. And all this, product that comes from these waste treatment facilities has got to go someplace. So I believe we as a society have to figure out what to do. I mean, they talked about dumps, essentially, you know, landfills. And then the other part was burning it. And then the other part was sludge or biosolids.
Right.
So it's all got to be dealt with one way or another. So maybe, you know, we can figure that way out.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of savings do farms get when they take in the biosolids versus using traditional fertilizer?
I do not have any idea. I do not have a figure on that. You could probably answer that better than I could.
Well, maybe not necessarily, but it definitely costs. Something else to consider, though, that I just wanted to add on is that it's not just biosolids that we need to be looking at, right? So if there or you're getting a new commercial fertilizer in, just the same with, you know, pesticides, things like that, we don't know where the PFAS is coming from those either. Could it be coming in through the containers that some of those are in? Is it coming right inadvertently through the manufacturing process? So it's still an issue that needs to be addressed. And it's, and again, it kind of comes back to your question about like, how can we let this happen? Historically, what we've been doing is implementing regs that limit it based on what the health risks are. And so going forward, once this health risk comes out, we will be limiting it to ensure that it meets all those health risks. But it's pretty hard to put a ban on something when people are flipping pancakes with their Teflon pan in their kitchen, right? So there's a lot going on this topic, and it's well beyond just the byproducts, and we need to hit it so much harder. But you're right, there are other commercial fertilizers available. They're more expensive. I mean, they're prone to over-application in many cases. You're buying something with a specific mix. Sometimes they're catered to your farm, sometimes they're not. You still have to make sure that you're applying appropriately to your farm and that you're working on getting the right material for what you're going to be growing.
Right.
Does that make sense?
There's also another hat that Molly wears is there's also lots of other clean compost out there. Sure. So there that doesn't have PFAS, heavy metals, all that kind of stuff. Just leaves. Traditionally, we incorporated leaves before we started collecting them and have to compost them and all that kind of stuff as a municipality. We used to directly incorporate them into fields. And a farm would want them. They need that organic matter. They need that as part of their nutrient systems. And there was an EPA study that was fairly recent, 10, 15 years ago, where they were growing really good peppers, red peppers, because they directly incorporated the leaves. And they were like, oh, wow, we just discovered something new where we can be doing this kind of stuff. We are so organic matter rich in the Northeast that we have all these nutrients that need to be recycled directly into the soil. And we can be using a lot less of the chemical fertilizers and the biosolids, which come with more problems than assets, I'm going to say.
Red?
Yeah, you made the comment that towns can enact on more restrictive regulations on things than what the state level is. And as a town official years ago, I was told the towns cannot enact regulations that are more restrictive than what the state levels are.
I don't think that's necessarily true. The thing that we're bringing up here and the reason it's relevant to this town specifically, right, is that when they put this moratorium in, so Ag and Markets has two avenues of right to farm to look at. One has to do with like neighbor complaint, a specific site complaints and things like that. They'll address a specific farming situation. You know, like we've seen them for like farm cannons, right? And things like that, pest issues. And so this is the other kind of, this is the other avenue of Ag and Markets right to farm laws, which refer to specifically municipal, I think it's broadly municipal laws that are implemented that could have impact farming. So that's what they're analyzing now. They're looking at whether or not the rule that was put in by the town interacts or interferes specifically with their right to farm law. So it's not that they've created a law period that's a problem or created their own regs. It's the problem is that, or what they're addressing, right? And what they're looking at and why it was brought up as a problem is whether or not it interferes with Ag and Markets right to farm laws. But we haven't heard from them on a response for that yet.
Elder.
So I'm going to ask my question that I asked at the very beginning. What should we be doing? Could we be doing anything? And Molly, you sound like you're the expert. Is there anything you can suggest? Because we get hit all the time saying county's got to do something to help us.
In the short term, I think banning. In the short term, extend the ban until we get the research together and understand what's happening here and whether we should be taking it in, because we don't know enough about PFAS. We just don't have that data because it's that new that we're actually looking at it.
So I'm going to defer about what you should do as far as bans go, because what we have in the science says that what you're doing is safe until, you know, you're over applying or something along those lines. If you're following all the regulations and you're maintaining everything properly, it should be okay. And we're obviously looking at PFAS very closely, and with the risk assessment, we'll be interpolating from there. One thing that the county, I think, can do is, moving forward, is staying apprised of the science, keeping contact, helping to educate the county when things come out, keep people informed, keep everything on your radar, right? And I'm happy to help in any way possible. I'd love to keep everybody informed as things progress. They're progressing quickly, and the science is changing rapidly and moving and accelerating. And we're learning a lot more about what to do at certain sites. We're meeting everywhere across the board on PFAS. And I think that it's most important for municipalities to be able to educate their residents on what's going on, what they can do themselves, and moving forward, if any rules, regs, anything are put into place, helping people understand why they're there, the science behind them, and how to move forward appropriately.
Okay, thank you very much. We, Steuben County Legislature, really appreciate you coming and spending the time to talk to us. Very informative, and looking forward to working with you in the future.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Anything else? Motion to adjourn.
Move it.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries.